So thank you for that introduction. Thank you for being able to speak. What I'm going to do today is in a sense, take the title of this series literally, and I'm going to go through the categories of the body, the space and movement, and with a view to looking ahead and into the future. But mainly, I'll try and let films, clips and images do the talking as a kind of a filmmaker. So I'd like to kind of start with something which is actually quite nostalgic as an image, it's a clip from Shadowing the Third Man, and this is where we all used to be.
The on-screen team is star-studded. The rivals, Trevor Howard.
I've got a car here.
And Joseph Cotton.
Be there in a moment.
The lovers, Alida Valli,
oh,
and Orson Welles. The off-screen team is international. Sir Alexander Korda, Hungarian-born producer. Graham Greene, the English novelist. Sir Carol Reed, the London director. Karl Hartl, the Austrian studio boss. And David O. Selznick, the US producer of Gone with the Wind. But the greatest character is Vienna itself.
So, take those images, we know them. Listen to the sound, the crackling of the film, the whirring of the machinery. It's deliberately intercut with the big wheel that's famous from Vienna. But it's deliberately intercut because this is the same technology. This is the technology of the 19th century. This is the technology almost in this country in terms of the Victorian age. And as an archaeologist, we're kind of used to looking at big chunks of time, not just small chunks of time. And what I'm very much aware of, and one of the big ideas I'd like to give across today, is that we are transcending a boundary between two major layers in relation to the production of history and the production of film. That was the past. That's history. Major camera producers, you may say, well, why is that? There are storage rooms full of film material. You can still go and buy film material. However, the major film manufacturers, the camera manufacturers, have stopped developing new cameras. It's a technology that is like hitting the buffers and will not die, but has become historical, just as other techniques are historical. Forms of oil painting, forms of other sorts of image manufacture. And we are now going into an age of which I think this sequence is redolent. I won't translate what they're saying, but they're actually very happy with what they're seeing. They're saying it's Freud dead butt, which means it's really amazing for those who aren't, because I'm a stream dialect. These are research scientists at one of the universities I work with in St. Pelton, who are developing new cameras, and what you're seeing there is a live X-ray. Okay. So obviously what you were seeing there was the live hand and the veins appearing. Now one of the points of this new age, and when we're looking into the future, is that the development of the technology is not majorly being made by filmmakers. It's being made by two major groups, and I'll go into more examples of this. One is medical imaging, and the second is the security industry. Those people in that department are colleagues from another department, not from my own media department, and they're doing that. Why? Because they want to have better scanners so that when you go through airports, you can be identified. Not just on fingerprinting, but on the shape of your veins. Okay? And that's what those images are being done for. I, of course, took one look at them and thought, wow, there's some interesting films that can be made. And, of course, that's the process by which culture and filmmaking takes place. But again, this is actually, I think, an image of the future, and it's something for us to think about in terms of the body. Now, we've been thinking quite a lot about this gentleman, and it was actually Emma who brought me back to him. In Vienna, we can have too much of Klimt. He's kind of too popular by his own success. When he was living, he was very unpopular. It's a very, very important thing to know. He was a rebel. He refused to exhibit. And one of the people who actually rebelled against him and the people who actually censored him were actually the university. So he is an artist who was very much censored by the university at its time and by academic conservatism. But one of the things that he particularly got interested in his work, and as I say, he's our first birthday because he was born 125 years ago, is actually this lady. This is Eva. It was the very last painting he painted. It was a private period in the final phase. He only painted it for himself and a very small group of clients. And we'll come back to those power issues later. Now, Eva's interesting is actually Emma's favourite painting, she told me. So I went and had a look at it. I hadn't seen them for a while. The gentleman behind is not important. He's not in the title. Klimt is known as the painter of women. He never married, but he had lots of children. He had lots of relationships. He lived with his mother. And I think he's the first person to paint women pregnant, etc., etc. So a very interesting person, very interested in men. And one of the things I noticed looking closely, and again a kind of an archaeological view is interesting here, is this is the close-up of his painting. And I was thinking, as a filmmaker, where's the light coming from on this image? And what I noticed was that the light is not coming from the outside, but actually from the inside. And again, working with projectors and now with LED screens like this, actually what I would posit, and one of the interesting things about Klimt's work, particularly the late work, is that he was already foreseeing our digital age in the way that he paints the body and in the way that he views the body, in that the light comes from the inside, just like the light on this screen is also coming partially from the back, partially from the front, but in terms of LEDs, it's only coming from the back, so it's glowing. So this is, in a sense, something which I found technically interesting, and it's something that I think we're going to come back to in terms of film and the digital age. Now, Klimt's key painting that he's painted as protest after he was rejected, all his paintings from the university were rejected, was a private commission called Nuda Veritas, and it's actually a model, it's a mythological figure, and in a sense it was a kind of protest for a small group. It had several titles. This was the first title. It says, truth is fire, and truth, and to speak truth means to glow and to burn. So again, we have this idea, is the truth, are the realities that we're all looking to get at, are those things that we come from inside our medium that we sort of glow out, or are they things that are projected onto other surfaces? And that's a relationship which I particularly, working with projectors, am interested in, but is actually, I think, also key to the film world. Because the old film world that you saw with the projector is very much, obviously, the analog image where we have an image that we can see, and that's projected onto another surface. In terms of the digital world, it's a completely different relationship, and we'll come back to that later. But those images glow. So, Klimt's Nuda Veritas takes us onto the issue with the body, where is the truth of those bodies? This is the original, this is the painting that he produced, and we'll see a lot of that close up, but obviously, as a filmmaker, I have to kind of open some doors to keep you interested. Now, I had a second experience this year, which also, for me, was a crucial experience and got me thinking, in a sense, about this this research. And we've mentioned Eve and the tree, and I, of course, thought in my head about this. I don't know whether you can exactly interpret it, but this is how, obviously, a huge event in our lives and how we start, and our birthdays actually start in the normal world, in an analog manner. And this is one of the events that actually made me think about my life and our lives bridging this gap between the analog world and the digital world. Since this is the oldest image of myself. Okay, it's black and white, it's 1965, it's got a crumple in it, and I was not very happy all of the time. And then, when I got lucky, the next transition was that then there were colour images. But that was about it. Up until that, that was the first image and proof, in a sense, that I exist, what I look like in terms of history. Now, this year, I was lucky enough that that protuberance, that tree, actually turned into this. And this was the first image that I saw of my daughter. This is actually how all of us now start as an image. This is the first proof of us. This is the first way that we know we are here. And these images were not done in a photo studio, they were not done in a snap camera. These are actually medical issues. As you can see, there's lots of data here, there's lots of all sorts of stuff that's happening here. And I was actually just filming over the back when my wife was having a scan. So this is then the first image of my daughter, and it then became actually a point of reference, interestingly, because when she was born, we were thinking, oh, she's looking rather like her scan. So the point is with this image is that we spoke in the 60s about expanded cinema. Well, now our phase is that our visual realm is expanded in our own lives, in our proofs of our lives, in our understanding of life, much earlier. And so her birthday and the day she was born, emotionally, is no longer so powerful as the moment when I first saw her. Okay? So within our own time, that's been pushed back, and pushed back by medical technology, not by anything else, and by very simple imaging. So here we again have the hospital, an image that's actually controlled, a person that's controlled, and this is how she looks at the moment. And I hope she's being a good girl, not giving my wife problems. Now, this is in a sense an idea of birth and a transition that we have in a relationship to the body that's very personal and in a sense is going inside us. We've already been thinking about this in film, and film has actually made these transitions. This is one of my very favourite images. This is actually the girl inside the false Maria. Obviously the iconic image of birth and transition from the technical into the biological that Fritz Lang created iconically for Metropolis. And as I say, I love the image of the girl inside actually needing a drink. So in terms of the body, however, and what Fritz Lang was talking about, and his wife who wrote the screenplay with him, was actually an image of fear, an image of how a society should not be. And so in that sense, the body here as something encrusted, immovable, technological in this sense, is now flipping as something that is a warning towards us. And this is, I think, a looking into the future of our digital world, because the most powerful camera, the biggest studios in the world, forget Hollywood, forget Bollywood, forget any of this, it's video cameras. It's supervision cameras. This particular camera was not in London. It's actually on a railway train in Italy. Okay, so it's even got there that, in a sense, you are being watched. The information is there to keep you happy, but also as a warning. This is a very ambiguous, ambivalent kind of symbol. It kind of, with this look, it looks more like something out of Solaris from Tarkovsky rather than anything else. But again, we have the body and we have technology and we have this digital future which is very powerful, but we don't know where those images are going. Yet they project power, they project control, and they project lots of those sorts of things. And in that question, there is a nudity, a nuda veritas, that is again ambiguous because we are being looked through. Okay, and it's that kind of that look which brings us back to our gentlemen here, to the developers who are having fun playing games with, in a sense, I actually find kind of quite monstrous. It goes towards the image Bunuel on the eye. Obviously, it's not the point of perception, it's that other kind of point. But again, it's the body, it's imaging, and it's technology. And it's this question of unity.
Yes, please, watch the image.
He's saying it's really terrible, but in a good sense. Like, I would translate as well wicked. Okay, so this is the joy of the people who develop it, but the question is what happens to these images? Okay, that then takes us to a second space and a second area that we're looking at, which is the idea of space in itself. And I think here we have to kind of, there's some very, very interesting opportunities that are opened up by the digital world and all of these things. Now, obviously, the iconic film that deals with all of this, like Lang's Metropolis, is The Matrix. And what I have here is something of the internet, because this clip, I think, is interesting because it's very much about the technology that produces this as well, which is very important. And so it continues. What I think is interesting there in the relation to space is that it's very clear that firstly it's related to time. Now that's obviously something we know from physics. But also that it's very much related to the technology. You saw the batch of cameras that were all up there. There we literally have almost like an artisan creation of 24 frames a second. Okay? But it's in the space of the creation rather than just the space of an action taking place and all the frames are within one camera. Okay? So this is for me the interesting thing about, but it's also the challenge you said about the amount of thinking that needs to be done, is that one has to kind of think, what's the technology, what is film, what do I really want to create? Because we kind of have this bubblegum time and bubblegum creations in terms of time and space as to what we want to do. And you saw, obviously, also with the working with model then with actors, that's also very much part of this digital age. That in a sense, you've got to plan things like that. But also, they are very expensive, but they're also very much teamwork. Okay. So in that sense, that's one of the things that I think the space is important. Of course, in terms of all of what you're seeing here, Hong Kong kung fu movies and the tradition from China is absolutely crucial. And this is actually Hong Kong people doing what has actually been done in Asia for a long time. But this amount of technology is something that has been brought to it and will continue, because obviously this is old hat by now. We'll come back to The Matrix a bit later. But again, it's looking at different levels of truth and looking at different levels of space. Now, I'm going to show a clip from another film. This was the 1960s, and this is where how space used to be captured. And where we actually run up to some of the issues of space in terms of old film. We also have a wonderful performance of Fritz Lang, who obviously was the creator of Metropolis in this film. I love that moment from Fritz Lang. There's so much in this film, Jean-Luc Godard, 1963. What I find interesting and important here is a memory, not just of the technology, but the space of the creation of the film, where those choices are being made. And one of the points that we have to think about is that in the digital age, we have even more options in terms of where we make those decisions. Fritz Lang at the beginning says Technicolor, the big pan across there, is a wonderful format for snakes or for funerals. But Jean-Luc Godard's then, in a sense, making fun of the Hollywood producer here in the creative tension, in the creating space, because as he throws the can of film, which I think is a wonderful symbol for the film world, for the turning. Remember the projector at the beginning of the talk I showed you. And he ironically says, oh, he has a sense for Greek culture, the discus throw. And so in a sense, what we have is that old idea of space in the frame, and that's what's being looked at here. Obviously, Fritz Lang's filming The Odyssey. And in a sense, an attempt to break out of that. And in a sense, that's where we are in that arc that we've been seeing with The Matrix. Okay, and I would say, and I would posit that in our time, the issue is not actually 3D in the sense of stereoscopic cinema. Okay? We're still caught in this position, we're still caught in that sense, just staring ahead. Okay? I call it tunnel cinema. That's not very interesting. Actually, the frustration that he has, the discus thrower, that image of the narrative spinning out is now able to actually go out in expanded cinema and is actually going out through other forms than traditional cinema, okay? And I'm going to show you a few ways in which I think now space within the digital age really works, okay? So we have space within the film and the production, and this is something I've been working on for a long time, and I call it, these are stills, I call it ambient cinema. These are stills from a film I've just completed called From the Pexel to the Pixel, together with Prehistoric Picture Project here in Cambridge, and my colleague Chris Dickendale, who's sitting at the back. And this is an installation that is running in Milan at the moment, and what we've done is that we have four individual walls. We have four projectors at the top. So you see what I mean? This is a photograph I'm taking to give that. And actually the idea is to actually break film out into the space all around us, 360 degrees. For me, that is the real third dimension. Okay? Putting the glasses on, whether you have glasses or not, Avatar is a fantastic film, fantastic technical achievement, but it still is in the end a vision where the body, you do not move when you're seeing it, you are still trapped and you're still staring in one direction. And I think that into the 21st century, that with digital cinema, this is actually where we're going, that we're able to break out into space. Okay? So this is very much an installation environment, and I'll show you some of the friezes of the film. So there's art sequences. This is then very much a kind of new age dream sequence. This is all archaeological prehistoric work from the Alps in what is now northern Italy. This is, for example, an image done with the Kinect, which is the video game, and we'll come back to video games, that we've distorted and processed in a particular way, but the original data is scanned data that was scanned from an image created 4,000 years ago, and that is hacked into the rocks of the Alps and is still there. Okay, so those are the kind of things that we're able to do, and that's the kind of contemporary aesthetic. But for us, as a film director, I can kind of think of that as a palette, as a big picture. In a sense, that was the dialogue that Fritz Lang was talking about, culture. But these are the four walls. This is the form in which we edit that. Okay, so we actually take it as a compass, north, south, east, west. And then what we're having to do is think of narratives, ways that actually space can actually work in a narrative context. So here we have someone who's the same blowing a horn. It's a dialogue. So what we have here is I'm having to create dialogues whereby him blowing the horn, in a sense, he pushes back because these two ends actually link up because it's a four. You see how we're already getting into the difficulty of 2D and 3D. And actually, it's an argument in which we also have another sequence where he blows and this wall gets pushed back over here. Then he goes back, that wall gets pushed back and over there. It's kind of Laurel and Hardy-esque in that sort of sense. But it is working with images in which I'm then able to put images next to each other rather than the tyranny that I've always had in 20 years of filmmaking where I've always had to put one image after another or maybe have a split screen. But split screen doesn't really do it either. So what I've been doing for the past 10 years is thinking how can we tell stories in space where those images work. Okay? So this is a very simple simple example. The next example was done in a planetarium with eight projectors on a circular space in which I have lots of frames, again, in a sense building together to form different shapes and different forms of narrative. It's a narrative of someone who is a sniper who is actually about to shoot someone. And he sees his victim running away. We cut back to the sniper, the victim runs away, and intercut with someone cutting garlic who's having a memory of this, an old man who's having a return of memory to one of the events from the war. And this is the new format has allowed me to show this in this new way. So I'll show you that again in a sense that there I have one frame. The next scene, so it's in the traditional sense, but imagine all of this is going around you. The projectors are actually moving as well, so they're coming up into the dome of the planetarium. And so I've got a traditional cut, but it's also in those images forming its own structure. Okay. So the idea of the loop, the idea of circularity, all of those sorts of things are actually able to put forward in a new way. So the falling of the blood, the falling of the soldier. There's actually something that puts these people into a spin. So for me, I'm very, very excited by being able to work like this because it allows me to just intellectually solve problems in a different way. And I'm actually closer to an architect, probably, in thinking spatially and thinking with films than I am maybe to a painter. Okay. And for me, that's something that it's very expensive, unfortunately, but it's something that I'm very interested in doing, and I hope you'll be able to see this film in the 6th of March. We'll be bringing some of these films to the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology and on Downing Street, and you'll be able to see those as first time in the UK. But coming back to the world of digital, one of the points is that I think what we're noticing with digital in this world is that actually images are going everywhere. G.K. Chesterton said when he was asked about people no longer having faith in the Catholic Church or in the Church, he said it doesn't want to stop people from believing, it'll just mean that they'll believe in anything. And I think the same is true of cinema in the sense that we'll no longer be just purely going to the cinema or even television now as the place to get our stories, to get our images, but actually those images will be everywhere. Okay? So obviously we've seen it on my flight coming over here, people were watching films, people watch films on their mobiles. This is actually a street opposite a very famous coffee house, opposite the Café Central, where Stalin met Trotsky and all of the other less violent intellectuals also met. Here is an advert for I think it's for a gentleman's tailor's. Okay, so we have the film language, we have the walking, we have that space, that sort of loop, and then we just have the ordinary city that's going on around. Okay, so these are whole new different meanings of space in the digital world, which is now possible and previously was not possible in that same sort of way. The second point that I would say in terms of space is something I recorded this morning, and that's the internet. If you've missed it, this is the declaration of my joining this committee, but my partner works for the BBC. Okay, enough of that. But what I mean is that within the space, even of this phrase, where we're seeing images, where we're able to view images, is absolutely condensed, but is also has actually been atomized in that sort of sense. So we have spaces, we have images everywhere, and they are integrated in a new way to the body in that sense. So that's a kind of almost like infiltration into the bloodstream of the way we live, also with our information, and also the way that I think a crucial point of the digital age is the way that text and image are mixed now, in the sense that we are multifunctioning in terms of reading in one form, taking in information in the other, and then the mixture of sound. So we are multitasking in that sort of sense. So I think that's a crucial image of space, in a sense, not so much the broadcast space, but the space of consumption being all around us, and in that sense, being ambient. So I come to the third category, and that is movement. So this is a clip from Shadowing the Third Man. Again, we're in Vienna, just around the corner from where we were before. And what you'll see is, in a sense, the way that movement was created, both in an analog manner, but also in terms of the way that film particularly works as this echo, but a physical echo, of actions that we have in the world. So it's something that really needs to take place. It can lie, but we still need movement. So listen to Guy Hamilton tell this story about how Harry Lime's shadow appeared. So what I find interesting and important about that particular sequence is that although the shadow is a lie, it really isn't Orson Welles, and the shadows were created by him not really being there, there was someone there who had to create that. That's what you need in film. You couldn't, in that sense, it would have been very, very difficult and impossible to do what they did in The Matrix, to create those images. That's, in a sense, that age of the production time. And it's also a sense in that point of film as evidence. The Third Man is all about things being there, not being there. but they actually had to create those effects in real life. And we do have this issue that in the old age of film, I'm calling it the old age of film, and it is that we do have an analog image where we can take a negative, we can put it out to the glass, and we can actually see that it's really there. In the digital world, we can't do that. We need translators, we need things to read, okay? And I think that is one of the utterly crucial points about evidence and about our trusting the media as to what's there and what's not there. So we've been talking about birthdays and Klimt. Now, Klimt didn't go to the cinema that much, and he didn't make films. It would have been very interesting for him to make films. At that time, cinema was not seen as being serious at all. Particularly at that age, it was seen as a fairground attraction. And only later did it become something that serious writers got involved with. So in a sense, one can forgive him for that. And actually, what I'm going to show you is a clip from the very first films that Austrian ever produced. So if you think of Ulrich Seidel and Michael Haneke now, that's the latest material. This is how Austrian film started. I have to tell you a little setup. The gentlemen have met, and they've had a little idea, and they've paid a lady who's standing in the right-hand corner. Well, I'll let the film speak for itself. So, there you go, Austrian film started brilliantly, didn't they? They haven't really changed very much, really. There's the major issue, the male gaze and naked women, sometimes. But these were known as gentlemen's films, and that was kind of clear that they were shown after dinner, etc., to gentlemen. What's interesting here, I think, for us, is the title first being Living Marble. So in a sense, the film being related to other arts. We've been thinking about space and movement. Obviously, that plays with that idea. But what I do think is the interesting point is that he gets dust all over him. Okay? And this is one of the reasons I selected this, because there's lots of these sorts of films for us to look at. Because again, it's a reminder that actually film, when it started, is a bunch of chemicals which react with the light and produce an image. It's something that literally happens. The naked film actually gets dirty with an imprint of something that happened. If there isn't anyone there in that sense, the light or an object, you don't get an image, okay? So it's a very, almost a visceral, it's a very direct relationship to that. The second point that's interesting in terms of the Nuda Veritas idea is that Aesop's fable right from the beginning was that there were two models that he was looking at. In the goddesses, that Prometheus didn't have enough clay to actually do the feat on one of them, who was the fake, who was the lie. And actually, the truth came alive, and the truth came alive and proved itself through movement. And this is, I think, one of the key things that we have in film that obviously will stay with us in terms of our understanding. But right from the beginning, movement was something that fascinated people, and we have to understand in these sorts of terms what that meant to them. So again, we have a key image of what film's about. Some of it we will get rid of, but some of it, as I say, this analog element is absolutely crucial as to what film was. And again, it has a positive nature in the sense of evidence. Now, here's the complete opposite in that sense. This is research that we've done. This is again one of the 4,000-year-old engravings. Well, we can't exactly date them, but they're all around that period. And what we've actually done is that into this rock, into the engraving, water was poured over that, so creating a natural movement. And then we added digital movement, so that this bird, for the first time ever, and this is what we can do by the magic of digital, can fly. So, for me, this is a wonderful symbol of where we've come over this period, in the sense that we have very simple analog processes that are going on. We have the rock, we have, you know, this is clearance, we have an image, but through the digital world, we've been able to create this, which is, for the first time ever, to be able to understand what these curves are, which were actually, in their imagination, these are beating wings. Sorry. And we've been actually able to do that. in terms of make those wins weak. But actually, they'd be better because we're doing the very simple things being done of water being poured across it, again, which is this idea of flow. So I think one of the things that looking to the future of beyond film is that within the digital world, we can actually, we're not losing materiality. We don't need to say goodbye to the analog world in terms of the elements and all of those other things, but we can actually do new things about it. So again, it's that relationship of lightness versus heaviness. So the second point is, and I think this is one of the things that digital allows us to do, is to link things up that weren't linked before in a way that took place probably in the imagination, and we're now able to actually literally make it happen, what previously was a metaphor or something you had to imagine. Now, this is one of these rock surfaces. This is the sun coming across it. There's rock art on here. This is a form of proto-cinema in which, rather than the light coming directly onto the image, it comes from the side, and again, it's the shadow that's actually providing a lot of the image. But a lot of this work potentially was also linked to places with particular sounds and particular acoustics. Now, that's obviously something we can physically do, take horns and all that. But actually, to get the idea of sound and acoustics going together, obviously that has a long tradition within filmmaking and music as well. We're now able to do that by actually using software that people use in nightclubs, the club DJs. And so we've taken two parameters, the movement, the image, and we've said pixelate according and more intensely according to the basses that are coming in. Okay. This is if you go clubbing, how you get your visuals being absolutely timed so perfectly to the beat. Because the digital world is allowing those two things to be commuting to each other. Okay, so again, this is the digital world all about metamorphosis. It's all about things changing into other things. This is obviously what the world of the zero and the dot is able to do. It's ultimately totally flexible, those sorts of things. And it's fantastic for us to be able to do those sorts of things. But obviously something in that interchangeability, in that mutability, is can we trust it? Okay, is there truth there? Is there truth within those images that we have? And those are obviously the things that we need to understand. Because this image, we cannot hold up to the light and see how this works. This is an algorithm. This is a set of processes. This is a whole software. This is a whole load of technology to have this happen. Remember the Matrix right at the beginning. So it's a whole different setup. One of the other things we've been doing with this work, as I say, I particularly like working with this material because it's so old and because it's so simple and it's just been hewn into the rock in that sort of sense. And actually then with this old material to apply the absolute newest material. I particularly kind of like that span. This is actually a scan where for the first time these images have not just been taken flat photographs but actually been scanned in depth. And then these images have been actually put together with animation software so that for the first time they can actually move in a natural sense. We've imposed some rules in the research project so only joints that we can literally see are allowed to be moved. Okay, so we call it Pitotti rules. Pitotti is the local dialect word for these figures. One of their meanings is small puppet. So in that sense, that's something that works for us in that sense. And you can see these are just first experiments as to what movement can mean for this. What we can also do out of that is that with these scans, we can create sculptures. So that from that image, from that actual scan, that's actually just air. We've been able to fill the air, and actually these are 3D prints that have just been done by Marcel Kanapka at the Bauhaus, who's been working with us. So in that sense, it's about, the transference from movement, from space, into something that's solid, and back again. And obviously this is something that we find very interesting, and allows, in a sense, with the idea of the shadow, from that 3D to create a 2D outlined image again the idea of the metamorphosis. So again we have levels of truth and then levels of mutability that we haven't been able to have before, which takes us back to this lady. As you can see from the size, she's very big. She's bigger than me. She's about 2 meters high, and she was painted for Hermann Bahr, who was a critic, who was a supporter of Klimt in his campaign against the majority of the media. And there's a new quote above there, it's a quote from Schiller, which basically argues that it is better to appeal to a minority and that it is bad to appeal to the majority. Okay? So it's a sense of very much a statement by these people, and these people are called the secession. They broke away from the major art market to form a kind of a small guerrilla group. Obviously now we're interested in their work, and the people they broke away from we're not interested at all. That's always the thing with avant-garde. But there's a kind of a spirit here in terms of the image and in terms of what is able to do. And I think one of the interesting points about the digital world is that it does, in its availability, etc., give potential to secessions, for people to go away and say, I don't care if I'm not the majority, I don't care if there's not that many people there, actually what I care about is that the image is for me, or that I'm able to express my particular self. So in that sense, the pixel is can be a very egotistical and very individualist thing that we have, because the old setup that we have was very much corporatist in terms of the way that films had to be made. So here we have her, the goddess, and we'll come to what she has in her hand. Usually it's seen as being a mirror, but as you can see, and we'll come back to this, it's actually not very clear what's able to be seen. But something that's also very interesting in her is that if you look at her eyes, she's got some light in the eyes. She's been lit. There is some light out there that she's looking at. Okay, so she's in that sense... Klimt, she glows as a muse, in a sense, for Klimt, but also she's looking at something, and that's something that I think is interesting in terms of where we are as filmmakers. So one of those points, I think, that when we come to the naked truth as to where we are with film today, is that we're not very far at all. This is actually, I wanted to see the television last night, the Savills material went down to Corpus, to the JCR, and there was nothing happening, and this is what I saw, and I found this kind of interesting, because there was actually one film, which was called Love Actually, but what I more was this, Games, and the FIFA football game. Because where I think we are at, and what the mass market that's happening in the digital world, are actually games, are actually video games, and what people are wanting, and what the audience is wanting, and this is the kind of the crucial light thing there, are these control systems. They want to be able to express themselves. And the key word is interact. And I think that's the movement that's actually involved. And I would propose that that's the movement that's particularly appropriate now for our digital age. It's the movement between the image and the audience themselves. So on the one hand, the audience in the ambient cinema, it's an open space. In fact, you are encouraged to turn. It's a 360 experience. You're not sitting down in an enclosed space. But here, in the games, you're able to actually play your own game. You're able to manipulate the image. You're able to be your own director or editor. The narrative is driven by yourself. You are both actor and director. Again, it's one of those mutabilities of who you are. And these games are amazingly powerful. Obviously, you know, the advertising that goes into the new production of a lot of this is much bigger than Hollywood films. Hollywood films are being driven sometimes by franchises that are coming from gaming. So in terms of us studying screen and media culture, okay, it's even hit Corpus Christi, Cambridge. Okay, and there were no Kieslowski films or anything like that around. So actually, there was Love Actually, but that was the rest. So that is, in a sense, one point. There are, coming back to the secessionists, someone I found here who is a fan of The Matrix, but also a kind of a culture that I've got interested in my own work, which is the kind of glitch culture. This is people interested, and we come back to Naked Truth, of actually finding the holes, finding elements of truth within the lie that the perfect image is. So this is someone anonymous from the internet who has saying to his mates, look what I found in The Matrix, look what's wrong. And so it goes on. Now, I mean, that's a film critic, you know. I mean, you know, we talk about film scholarship. That's film scholarship to a detail. What's fantastic there, I think, for our appreciation is that on the one hand, we've seen how technically perfect all of this sort of has been done, yet there are these glitches which are in there for, obviously, for all of that. He hasn't believed the kind of the bullshit, or how can I say, the marketing speak that we saw right at the beginning from the technical maker. There are all these things in there, and what's he doing? Individually finding the glitches, appreciating that sort of point. So there we have a naked truth as well that is searching within the film, within the digital world, for, in a sense, those ghosts in the machine. I've been doing something similar in Valcamonica. We call it dirty morphing. And what with morphing, the idea is usually to create absolutely perfect images. What I did with these images, because I was bored with them, is that I worked with a colleague, Christian Mirat, and I said, just combine everything with everything and put in algorithms. I don't know what your algorithms are, but make this shift, make something happen. And so we just used to leave the computer overnight to sort of churn away and do this stuff. And so out of boring shots of the valley, etc., we actually have images. And we even get moments like this, which is my famous moment, where it just becomes the computer itself. It got so overloaded in terms of linking everything with us that actually the machine, the basic bedrock of the computer, appeared itself. So here we have the bedrock of these prehistoric images in water and obviously morphing into each other in particular forms. So we call it dirty morphing. It creates a particular image which you'll see in the pixel element. We could never do this in an analog world, and this is, in a sense, a lot of the nature of that. And I actually find quite interesting is that when you look at time-lapse photography and the way that nature works, suddenly you start seeing links in the way that the aesthetics are created and the way the materials are kind of there. So there is a, I don't know whether that's Zen or whatever, but anyway, there's an interesting kind of link in terms of the aesthetics and in terms of the way we're linking those sorts of things. So we come back to Our Lady. What should we do about the eyes? We can see here he has put light in the eyes. There's something out there that she's looking at, our naked truth. And we do have, looking back, the old world truth of the film world of the cinema, and I come to Romy Schneider. So coming back to that world of cinema that we were before, I would say that we are going beyond film, but we are not going beyond cinema. And I think that's one of the crucial points that I've realized, that film is a historical phase that we talk about, and when we do, we'll see how the word, what the career of the world will be. But cinema will remain as an experience. And that is something that remains, whether it's digital or whether it's produced by images that you can directly see in terms of its evidence. So actually, I think one of the key things that she's looking at is actually a projector. And that this, which she has in her hand, is a mirror of something. Well, I love the point of seeing the camera from The Matrix in that detail. Maybe that's the camera or the lights that were shining at her, and that's a glitch as well. But actually, Klimt is leaving it ambiguous. It's also kind of like a magnifying glass, and I like that ambiguity. And the kind of crucial point, I think, is for us to remember, and this is where I'd like to finish, is that we are interacting in our brains with the film and with the image, no matter where it is. What you will see is a clip from the Romy Schneider film. These are clips from her analog films. I'm in a boat. We are riding at night around the Ile de Cité in Paris, projecting onto the banks of the Ile de Cité. And this very magical moment happened, which I'm going to show you, and it's my favorite moment, I think, in all the films that I've ever made. And I think it's kind of symbolic for what cinema's about. And actually, in the end, is what's happening in our head, which we don't really understand yet. And that's where, in a sense, whether it's digital or whatever, we will not get beyond that moment of cinema. And that is a moment of interaction, and it's the moment that is individual. So I'd like to leave you with this image.